You're listening to Last Word Soccer Club Radio. Only here, lastwordonsports.com.
What's up, Internet? My name is Matt Pollard, and you are listening to Last Word Soccer Club Radio, only here, lastwordonsoccer.com, powered by Last Word on Sports Incorporated, the Beautiful Game Network, and Roughneck Scars. We've got a great show for you this evening, talking about a bunch of big news and notes in MLS. We've got a bunch of fun stadium and mascot stuff to talk about in the roundtable, and a full slate of pick-ems as we've got pretty much MLS teams in action all through the rest of this week, including tonight. We just got finished with DC United playing Montreal Impact to a 0-0 draw. My good friend Daniel Sperry, what did you think of this match, and how hyped are you to see Quincy Ameriquois getting some minutes with Wayne Rooney suspended?
Yeah, I mean, good for Quincy. I was actually happy with the landing spot. I thought it was really good. Wayne Rooney, when DC, as random here, but when DC United are kind of at their best, Wayne Rooney's got his back to goal and guys are running off of him. Quincy Ameriquois does really well in that kind of defensive forward. He's going to back into a guy, play with his back. He's got, play with his back to goal. He's really comfortable there. He's good on the turn and taking a shot. He's also fine distributing it to others. I think it's a good fit. Obviously, they didn't get a goal tonight. However, not a lot of people outside of Sporting Kansas City have been scoring goals on Montreal. You know, that's their one blip on their radar. And they were were suspended and injured and all kinds of stuff for that game, and got, you know, Sporting just kind of ripped them apart, in terms of pulling them out of shape. But you know what? And you know, Montreal's been keeping a lot of teams off the board. I'm not surprised this one ends up 0-0 just because it was so close after the game week. A Tuesday midweek game is always super weird. Don't know why it's played tonight, but interesting. But good for Quincy. The guy deserves a good spot in the league. He almost helped, really, when he came into Montreal last year. He really almost helped them sneak into the playoffs at the last second there. It was some really good play, I think. As the season goes on, as we see Wayne Rooney subbed out a little bit more, we see him injured, see him just getting rested in general, as fixture congestion really starts to pick up here in the next few months, you know, you'll see a little bit more of Quincy, and you'll see a little bit of the value that he brings, being that second striker option for them off the bench. And I really thought last year it was a shame that the way everything went down with the Star A and San Jose, that Quincy Ameriquois looked wonderful in preseason and was never given a chance. He and Mondo looked really good together, as they have been in the past. So, kind of a shame that it never worked out for him there in San Jose, in his hometown. But, you know, good for him to get a good opportunity in DC. And didn't work out tonight, didn't get a goal, didn't have a whole lot to show for it. But I think Quincy, like I said, in the long run, will be good for DC United.
Let's transition that right into one of the topics that we wanted to talk about at the top of the show, and that's just the current state of DC United's form going into this past weekend. Probably the marquee match, at least certainly for me, on the weekend, was DC United hosting LAFC. Pretty decent early afternoon kickoff, you know, really plausible for everybody who wasn't trying to run, you know, errands all the way up to an evening MLS match that they were potentially trying to get to. Game was nationally televised. The broadcast opened with a I don't know if you saw this, Dan, but Rob Stone and Alexi Lawless actually previewing the show from the supporters section, and they had multiple people offering them beer live on TV, and you kind of saw how there was a slight stutter where Alexi Lawless is a professional. He is very, very good at his job. I would assume that the professional in him would not want to consume alcohol in that situation. I think Alexi Lawless the person, I think Alexi Lawless the soccer bro, that was absolutely his happy place. And that part of him was very, very sad that he didn't at least get to take a small sip, especially because it was in the it was in the 70s and they were right in the sun. And I don't know how much makeup they were in. Yeah. You know, everybody around them was in athletic wear jerseys that are, you know, designed to breathe very well. For the most part, shorts are not anything anything thick, and obviously he and Rob Stone are sitting there in navy and dark suits. But then after that, it was kind of it was all the LAFC show. You know, Carlos Vela takes a PK early on in the game. Bill Hamid ends up saving it, but then Vela scores in the 15th minute. You later had a hat trick from Diego Rossi, his first in MLS play. You know, lots of assists from other players all over. They get a clean sheet at Audi Field, which is not very common for MLS, for Western Conference teams to get there. And then Wayne Rooney ultimately set off in the 52nd minute. You know, this was LAFC from the opening minute were clearly the better team in how they approached it. Mentally, their mindset from the opening whistle was much better. It showed, and ultimately they coasted off to a relatively easy victory, both because of the scoreline, and ultimately DC United had, if not their best, certainly their second best player sent off, and the guy who was going to have to be massive for them to try and get back into the game. The red card occurred in the 52nd minute. At that point, it was already 3-0. It was 3-0 at halftime. We had some concerns. In hindsight, we could say from last year, Dan, the DC and I really just needed Audi Field to open up. They needed a fresh start with the stadium opening. And they needed Wayne Rooney, but there were still games either where Rooney was subbed out or wasn't able to play last year that they looked kind of like the old, you know, the last year at RFK, Benny Ball sort of a situation with DC United, lacking in some ideas, maybe lacking in some energy and not having the mentality of maybe Rooney out there or just Lucho Acosta and then a bunch of parts. We've now seen two games consecutively against, I would say, decent teams. I have Montreal as a bubble team in the playoffs, LAFC, certainly the class of the West up there with Sporting Kansas City and Seattle Sounders, and DC United flat out got outplayed, and you can't just blame it on the red card because it was 3-0 at that point. There were some issues defensively. I think LAFC was ready to handle what they were doing in the what DC United was doing in the midfield very, very well. And in that sense, I would say Bob Bradley certainly outcoached Ben Olsen. You know, Bob Bradley, it's probably him. And then it's probably him and Peter Vermees as far as the true, you know, 3D chess players of PMLS coaches. Ben Olsen's a little bit simpler, maybe not as historically has been as well versed in some of his tactical nuances. So I thought he got outcoached. I thought they got outplayed from a mentality standpoint. And then once they finally got into the game at that point, you know, LAFC was able to play the scoreline and the result, and then ultimately play up a man, which is very beneficial for them, having to travel literally all the way across the country. And then we saw, you know, right before we hit the record button, that Montreal was able to bunker in, and without Wayne Rooney, it was effectively just disrupt everything getting to Lucho Acosta, and when Lucho Acosta gets the ball, immediately disrupt him. Your thoughts on the last two games that DC United has played, how much of it is concerning, and is this team a paper tiger sans Wayne Rooney?
I think they might be a paper tiger sans Wayne Rooney. I mean, like I said, I do like Quincy Mariquois. I think this DC United team, there's a whole lot of talent on it, in terms of, goalkeeper Bill Hamid has been fantastic this year. I had some questions about him going into the year. I feel pretty at ease with what he's going to bring to them as a goalkeeper. They're full, you know, Leonardo Jara got hurt tonight, came off, but he's been fantastic. You know, they've got a solid group in the midfield in Moreno and Segura and Canoes. They also have, you know, Areola and Lucas Rodriguez, and then you have Lucho Acosta in there. I think they're a solid team, without Wayne Rooney, they go from potentially being the class of the Eastern Conference and a top 3-4 team in the league to, you know, I'd lump them in there next to Columbus. You know, Columbus, they're not spectacular, but they know how to get the job done. At times they can be spectacular, but at times they're not. They're just very pragmatic. Everything that Columbus has done so far under Caleb Porter's just been very pragmatic. And I imagine that to be very DC United, just because that is Ben Olsen's nature. The ability to have Wayne Rooney on the field, and linking everybody up and making everything happen. I think that is what makes them an upper echelon team, is having an upper echelon player like that, because they have all the fringe pieces down solid enough that they, you know, once they insert an elite playmaking talent like Wayne Rooney, and goal scoring talent as well, into a lineup, then that potentially can make them elite. I think you saw, though, on Saturday, the difference between actually being an elite and being close to elite. And what happens there is what, you know, Mark Anthony Kay in the midfield and Edward Atuesta did a fantastic job time and time again turning guys over in the midfield. They did not, you know, out of those four goals, I think three of them came from direct turnovers within the middle third of the field as DC United are attempting to play out of the back or play from the midfield into that attacking group of players. Either a misplay by Moreno, a bad touch by somebody else. You know, I think those are DC United, I think is at their best when they play very direct. And I think DC United tried to get too cute in keeping LA off the ball. And while LAFC are really good at dominating possession at times, they are really good at doing both. That's the thing, is that that's that elite level of where, you know, DC United has not shown to me yet in what I've seen from them that they can handle a game where they dominate possession and teams bunker them in. They have not shown to me yet that they can go into that game and win comfortably. LAFC can do that. Few other teams can do that, but LAFC are also comfortable playing a very direct game. And they came in with a game plan that was just set to disrupt and then pounce and make sure that front three was going to do something. Latif Blessing was good in the midfield, but really it was all about the turnover in the midfield, feeding Carlos Vela and making something happen from there. And once they did that, you know, that it was, you know, DC United had so many numbers forward because they were in this, all right, we're going to play out. They just seemed to capitalize on that moment of playing out of the back and into the attack and in through that from the middle third of the attacking third and all that, that every single time DC United felt like they had something going in possession and build up, LAFC capitalized on that. So I think right there is the difference. I think DC United is better suited to be very direct, be a much more direct team and just try and hit at you hard constantly and do it in a very very north-south way, not so much moving the ball east to west. I think they got too cute on Saturday, tried to keep the ball away from LA, and LA just kind of showed that they can do that, that they can play that game as well. I don't know if it's hard to read so much into that game yet because I still think both teams have room to grow. I think LAFC, as good as they've been, I think they still have room to grow. I think DC United as well have plenty of room to grow. So it is very early in the season. But I'll be interested to see how DC United kind of changes out of that game. Do they start to be a little bit more direct? Because I don't think that overall that we saw it tonight, you know, that the overall trying to dominate teams in the way that a Sporting Kansas City would, or maybe an Atlanta United did last year, would do that to teams. Even Columbus at times last year under Berhalter, just being able to hold on to possession and just kind of pin teams back and then go get the goal. I don't see DC United being that kind of a team. They seem to be really good in transition and really good at breaking people down. I'd like to see them embrace more of that direct style. I think that's the difference, is that, you know, if you are going to be elite like LAFC, you've got to be able to play both those game states. And I don't think DC United's there yet.
I agree with your categorization that, like, you know, let's say Wayne Rooney never gets signed by DC United, but they still, you know, have a relatively decent second half of the season. Maybe they end up playing a road playoff game and losing in the first round. Just thought experiment. I agree with your categorization that that team going into 2019 is probably a, you know, on par with a Columbus Crew. I think even with Wayne Rooney, this is still definitely a very, very good team. This is a team that I think is capable of competing for Supporter Shield or an MLS Cup. Let's, again, in my hypothetical area, Dan, let's assume that Lucho Acosta, by hook or by crook, is with the team through the end of the 2019 season. I think that DC United is suffering a little bit from what we saw from Atlanta and Tata Martino figuring things out with Atlanta last year, where DC's a very well-built team. They've got depth and options at a couple different positions. They're pretty much stacked from front to back in terms of their preferred, everybody healthy, 90 minutes fit, starting 11. but they've got a very distinct way of playing, as you just described, and they don't really have a decent, good second gear. And Atlanta realized that they could sit back and be a little bit more counterattacking and attack the spaces, have Joseph Martinez and Miguel Marone roam between the spaces and the lines of the opponent and still be effective. They at times they could beat teams by playing tiki-taka. At times they could beat teams by being a more elite counterattacking team that still had some sound defensive structure. And it took Atlanta a couple of months to figure that out, figure out and experiment enough such that they had two distinct gears. They beat the Red Bulls at home with one of them in convincing fashion. They got a result on the road at New York Red Bulls in the second leg of the Eastern Conference Finals in convincing fashion, albeit not with the scoreline. I can't remember, did New York get a goal in that one? In any case, Atlanta advanced and it was never in doubt on aggregate. And then they went back to the original format of, you know, playing tiki-taka and playing through the middle and, you know, were hands down the better team over Portland Timbers in MLS Cup that they hosted. And I feel like DC has a very, very good distinct thing that they do really, really well. And when they're not 100% at that, or one of their two best players isn't available for a game, or the opponent does everything to neutralize that, they don't have a distinct second gear that they can go to. They don't have a really good counterpunch to go through, and I think that's something that they're going to have to evolve in, or experiment with, or try and massage, or try and come up with an alternative for when their main go-to isn't working for a variety of reasons. Let's move on to some happier news, Dan. We're going to be talking about a lot of stadium stuff tonight. Allianz Field, the new home of Minnesota United, will be opening this coming Saturday. We will be previewing that game for Pick'ems when we get to it at the end of the show. But I don't know. I've seen the renderings. I've seen all the pictures, Dan. This stadium looks absolutely fantastic. You've got kind of like the supporters wall situation that we've seen in Orlando, and then more recently with the 3252 at LAFC. They've got the big loon head in there. They've got the loon. I don't know if it's wings or feathers technically. In the middle of the midfield, you've got all the fancy cool little blue different colored seats that I don't think any MLS team has done with any really good significance. They've got the huge brew hall that I'm sure is going to have a lot of fantastic stouts for a potential late fall or even a playoff game into November or December. They've got the cool analog clock, which is very like old school, like old, like mid-1900s stadium in England format. The stadium looks absolutely fantastic. It looks beautiful. I hope that it sells out every single game. And on top of that, Minnesota United has 3 wins in 5 road games so far, and they're looking a lot better defensively. I think this is the perfect timing, both in the season and in where this team is as a club overall, in terms of opening a new stadium, having their proper home, and ushering into, you know, a team that I think is going to be able to be competitive for the next couple of years in MLS. Your thoughts on the stadium and all of that word salad that I put together, Dan?
Yeah, I love the stadium. I think the cool thing about the analog clock, and it's not just the analog clock. I mean, it's the old scoreboard, that it's a throwback to the original field that they played at, when they were, before they came to MLS and before they were playing at TCF Bank Stadium.
When they were the Minnesota Stars.
Yes, and the old scoreboard there and the clock. So it's the old style clock and then the scoreboard is like these giant flip card numbers that just kind of flips over. And so it goes from 0 and the guy goes over and grabs it and flips it over to 1. It literally a manual scoreboard kind of a thing. That's going to be super cool to see that. I mean, I've seen the video pictures of it. But to kind of see that in action this weekend is going to be awesome. Every single thing I've seen from the stadium, I remember it's kind of funny. In hindsight, so I really liked Avaya when it came out, when that was a brand new stadium. Now it's kind of grown south on me, but I thought it was very fun. I laughed because the guys who from Minnesota United who were talking about opening up Allianz Arena and or Allianz Field, Allianz Arena. There's like 3 Allianzes somewhere around the world, but they were talking about it and they were kind of like, oh, you know, we're not going to just build some random stadium that just looks like a bunch of bars and stuff and steel and stuff like that. Like, this is going to be good. This is going to be cool. And I kind of laughed at them because, if you've ever seen a Avaya stadium, it just looks like a literal skeleton of a stadium, kind of plopped down next to the airport. And there was always the promise of covering, but they've never actually delivered on that. A's ownership. I'm not surprised, but, Minnesota United, now that, you know, have turned in this absolute gem of a stadium that they're about to open up. I believe they're using somewhat, maybe not the same exact, but pretty close to the same field heating, like the field surface heating stuff that Sporting Kansas City used, which allows them to melt the snow off the field and keep that going. They're using the grow lights and stuff like that, that's used in England. I know New York Red Bulls do it, and Sporting Kansas City have done it as well. Or they've added the grow lights to the field management and stuff like that. That in itself is huge, just because of the prospect of playing games in Minnesota in very cold conditions plenty of times. That field is going to feel at game times like 45, 55 degrees when it is 20 degrees, 10 degrees, 0 degrees and snowing outside, just because of the technology that they'll be able to put in that stadium at the field level. The stadium looks great. It's a massive concourse. It looks easy for fans to move around and be comfortable. It's massive. The supporter section looks great. I mean, everything about the stadium looks great. Right now, I'm interested to see how it goes. It may be next to, like, up there with Bank of California Stadium as like a crown jewel, soccer specific stadium. Cause this, what they've done with this, they've turned, it's at a smaller scale, but they've turned in something that's absolutely world class, which not a whole lot of the soccer specific stadiums right now.
No, good stuff, Dan. I completely agree. It looks fantastic. I almost, based on the size and the shape, I would say that it's actually closer, and the layout, I think it's closer to Sporting Park than it is to Bank of California Stadium, but it's its own thing. It's Allianz Field. And I'm happy for Minnesota in the sense that we saw them not spending a whole lot of money in their first couple of years, I presume because ownership was using some of the revenue towards that. So I wonder, with them having their own stadium, we've seen that improve teams. You saw it firsthand with Sporting Kansas City, and just even the proof of concept going back to the original Columbus Crew Stadium, now Matt Free Stadium, in terms of teams controlling the venue, controlling the revenue, being able to charge and gain revenue from parking and other places, holding other events. I assume, you know, this is a field that could easily hold some high school football or high school soccer throughout the state of Minnesota that would probably be a better size for some of those smaller venues, rather than having to go to TFC or the Vikings' new stadium that looks like the overturned Viking ship. Obviously, outdoor concerts, especially when the Loons are out of town over the course of the weekend, is going to be fantastic. And I'm wondering if that's going to open up some new purse strings for Minnesota to where they're actually going to be able to have quality DPs. You know, is the new stadium and everything they're going to get, is that going to be enough capacity for them to get you know, another Kevin Molino type, or even maybe a Darwin Quintero, or a B plus, or let's say a B minus version of Darwin Quintero. And if they're able to get that and continue to still improve, and then maybe, you know, as the academy, you know, matures a little bit more, I think we're looking at a much more stable club, where just 3-4 years ago, you know, they were kind of the butt of MLS, you know, where everybody was just making, you know, Haim Demidov memes before. So it's a fantastic stadium. I'm really, really excited to see it. And I'm sure that New York City FC is very, very excited to play on an actual soccer field with real quality grass. But I'm bummed. Let's move on, Dan, to some not so much fun stuff. It's likely, folks, that at least on the MLS front, CCL Fever will be going dormant later this week, as Sporting Kansas City is the lone MLS team left in CONCACAF Champions League, and off of their leg one game at Monterrey, they lost 5-0, so they're down 5-0 on aggregate. Tigres dispatched of Santos Laguna very handily, so it looks like we're looking at a all Monterrey derby for the final, most probably. Dan, I was not able to watch the CCL game because I was at the United States women's national team game, watching Mallory Pugh come off the bench and get a brace to help the United States women defeat Australia as they tune up for the World Cup. Talk me through this game. Talk me through what happened and how ultimately I'd say the most expensive team in the history of North American soccer, completely dismantling what I would consider one of the most stable model mid-tier market franchises in MLS. Like, what, you know, what went wrong last Thursday and why?
Yeah, so I think what went wrong is just that Sporting Kansas City are, and even Peter Ramiz, can be stubborn to a fault at times. They're going to play the game their way, and that's how they're going to do it. And, you know, at times, results be damned. I don't know how many times Peter said this on radio interviews, TV, even to us. He said this quote, you know, I don't know how to play it any other way than this. And that's just kind of how that's his nature, is to take it and run right at you. And they're going to try and possess and try and do that. And, you know, if they lose 5-0, they did it because they played the way that they felt they should have played. And that is just kind of what happened. And Monterrey, did a really good job of picking apart the things that were kind of crucial to their success. And then turning that into a way that Monterrey can take advantage of. And they threw a ton of numbers forward on Sporting Kansas City. I don't think Sporting Kansas City has really done well with teams who try and take the game to them. That's a very, you know, they're not used to defending. They don't do a whole lot of it at times, but in the times that they do, they can look shaky because they threw it a whole lot. And they got stuck having to really defend, against guys who were just faster, stronger than any of the other competition they faced, that it came up the way it did. I'm not surprised. I'm a little surprised by the scoreline. I'm not surprised that Sporting Kansas City looked as far out of their depth as they were, especially on the road. I think the home leg will be a little bit different. Monterrey, I don't say they don't travel well, but their results, you know, they've been taking care of their results at home, and just kind of grinding out results on the road. We'll see what happens on Thursday night. You know, I'm not sold that they're going to come back nothing and make all of a sudden turn this into penalty kicks. Do I think they could make it really interesting? I think they could. I wouldn't be surprised if Sporting Kansas City ended up winning on Thursday night. But I also, I see it very hard for them to get back into it. And, you know, I think it's just a product of who they are and of who Peter Vermes is that, you know, down to nothing, you know, they're never going to decide, okay, maybe we'll throw on another defender and just try and keep this scoreline manageable for the home leg. You know, they were going to push to try and get a goal, get two goals and get back into it at, you know, after that halftime. And, you know, Monterrey just their quality overpowered. And I think that's just kind of what you saw. I think that's what happened really on Thursday night, is that, you know, Monterrey are just that much superior than Sporting Kansas City. And that's kind of where we're at. I mean, that's what happens when you have a roster, like what Monterrey has.
I think American and Canadian soccer fans looking at Champions League as a barometer for where their team is or where the league is or where they are, either as a Canadian soccer nation, an American soccer nation, vis-a-vis Mexico, there needs to be a massaging or a recalibration of viewing the competition and how it plays. I think the new format certainly suits all the leagues and all the individual clubs a lot better. But for the most part in this tournament, it's been a lot of the same faces. In terms of teams that are making a deep run, it's usually a team that's in a 2 to 3 year window, in all competition, whether that's Copa MX, whether it's the Clausura and the Apertura, the actual league play in Mexico, and then Champions League as well. But outside of those, you know, there was a year Pachuca won it. I think Omar Gonzalez was on that team, for example. You know, you've seen Toluca here and there. I think Querétaro was in it once. But, you know, outside, it's a lot of teams that are one-off, and then a lot of teams that have been regulars in the tournament, where it's the Club Americas, the Tigreses, the Monterreys, the Chivases, to a lesser extent, Zolos, though Zolos is always kind of up and down how it is. I would say Santos is maybe that next one after that main group of usual suspects that I mentioned, because they were frequent in this tournament, certainly when Hercules Gomez was starting for them on the wing and, you know, had his evil Mexican, you know, goatee mustache combo that he would stroke as he would get media questions from, you know, Santos only getting a 1-1 draw, for example, and saying, no, we're going to be fine. We're going to win the second leg 5-0. It's going to be fine. But the money injection that has happened and the international talent influx, particularly in their prime international talent coming into Mexico in ways that players are not coming into Major League Soccer right now. Obviously, MLS is going to be able to get a Zlatan or a David Villa or, you know, a Cristiano Ronaldo in ways that Liga MX isn't going to get. But Dario Benedetto has been rumored a number of times of coming to MLS, a lot with the Galaxy. I think both of the New York teams at separate points, and it's never really happened. There are guys who are top tier talent players coming out of whether it's Chile, Brazil, Argentina, who are coming to Liga M or who are coming to Liga MX in ways that they would only be going maybe 5 years earlier to MLS or 5 years after to MLS, either at the end of their careers or as a jumping board to try and get something sooner. You know, let's say, Miguel Almiron does good in Newcastle, for example, I think, but, you know, not well enough to where he's starting and he wants to come back to the other hemisphere. I think he'd be more likely to go to Liga MX and find success there than he has already, having already conquered MLS. And, you know, I think Peter Vermees said it really well. He might have said this to you, Dan. I don't remember where I heard this. He might have said it a couple different places. You know, realistically, Monterrey has, you know, if you plot Monterrey into MLS, they've got 7 or 8 DPs. They need 15 international slots immediately. And I think the spending has exploded for a handful of teams in Liga MX who are regulars in this competition, who are juggernauts in, you know, juggling multiple competitions simultaneously over a season in ways that MLS doesn't have that. I think that is something that Atlanta and LAFC aspire to be. I think that's something in MLS 2.0 in a different format of CCL, and I would say a different Liga MX when they still had the 8-10 rule for Mexican internationals. I think that era, that was something that the LA Galaxy and the Seattle Sounders attempted to be and came up a little bit short on. I think Sporting is capable of being that, but you know, it's never, other than the New York Red Bulls recently, it's never been the exact same cast of characters every single year in MLS in the way that it has been for Liga MX. So if you just talk about, you know, let's say, you know, the Swiss Super League, for example, or pick any middle tier European league where it's somebody different every single year in Champions League, one of those teams, you know, hitting their peak and trying to do something in that tournament is still very much the small guy next to, you know, middling Arsenal, who's just trying to finish third, who's finished third in the league, who's still going to get out of the group, who's still going to get top four in the Premier League relatively easily. And I think that is what Tigres is at its absolute worst in the last 3 or 4 year period, where, you know, Legia Warsaw or a club like that coming up, you know, would be a Sporting Kansas City this year, or, you know, possibly a DC United next year. And you just don't have the consistency and that same level of quality. And if you just look at the amount spent, I think a lot of fans who are lamenting the current state of MLS compared to Liga MX should revisit that and think that maybe that should lead to, you know, some other changes. I think Atlanta going out the way that they did against Monterrey was disappointing. I think just considering the level of spending that were different, I just think when you come up against one of these giants, I think that's a different situation. Or you need to catch lightning in a bottle like Toronto FC did. But, you know, if you're not going to have a super club in MLS that has, you know, is maxing out on TAM and has 3 big all contributing in their prime DPs, I think that's really the only shot you have to go pound for pound with a Monterrey, a Club America, a Tigres. And I think we should take that into account when going through all of the other hot takey cliches that MLS Twitter goes through every single year, ultimately when MLS is eliminated from winning Champions League. Let's look at one more final chaotic thing as far as our main topic, Dan, and that, of course, was Orlando City SC's big 4-3 win over the Colorado Rapids this past weekend. You had goals, you had lead changes, there was a PK, halftime ended up being in excess of 1 hour and 17 minutes, based on my Twitter analysis from when I tweeted that halftime had started, and then ultimately when they kicked off in the second half due to a torrential downpour. This game had everything with the exception of a snow classico and a red card between two really struggling teams. As I previewed going into this week for my Rapids coverage for Last Word, I said one team was going to get a result to feel good about one way or the other. Like, somebody was going to walk out of there with a clean sheet, somebody was going to walk out of there scoring a goal, and ultimately somebody was going to get points who previously wouldn't have anticipated it. It ended up being Orlando. The Rapids are struggling right now defensively in so many ways. Nani is an absolute crazy person, and I don't know about you, Dan, but like, I would not want to randomly bump into him in an alley that's dimly lit and there's nobody else around me and it's at a really unfavorable evening hour. This game was absolute madness. I don't know how to make sense of it. And as crazy and as fun as it was, I'm still convinced that both of these teams are really bad, not making the playoffs. Dan, make sense of this chaos for me.
Yeah, I mean, it was fun. Yeah, I'll say that. I actually love watching Bassett. He's been really good for me the last few games. I have been impressed with what he's done. But yeah, dude, that was a whole lot of chaos. It's actually really funny because I texted Matt off air, and I was watching, or not off air, but before the game, and I was watching. Originally, I was supposed to do something on the FC Dallas and Philadelphia game, and I was kind of, I was ready for the Portland game, which started a half an hour later, Portland San Jose, but I was expecting that one to be terrible because both teams are terrible. But the Earthquakes winning made that one very, like, worth talking about, considering the Earthquakes have been the laughingstock of the league. Three different broadcasts I had listened to on Saturday at some point mentioned that the Earthquakes were very bad and were very, very bad, like really, really bad. So anyways, I text Matt and I was like, and I was, as I was watching the Philadelphia Dallas game, I was like, I'm sorry you have to pay attention to such a crap game. And he did, every single time somebody scored, he just kept texting me back and just being like, Nani heard you. Kai heard you. You know,
all that kind of heard you.
I think when I blamed the goal on the center for Kai's goal on the center back, I think you'd said, well, fine, Salif Sané, I heard you. Anyways, I mean, it was a crazy game. It sounds like a lot of fun to me. I didn't get to watch it in its full, just because I was paying attention to Philadelphia Dallas, which in turn was crap, for the most part. And then, you know, it was Dallas getting a great free kick goal and then just Philadelphia attempting to score a goal for 90 minutes and getting two in the last 10. You know, and then the Portland San Jose game, I was just enamored with the fact that San Jose were scoring goals and playing good and looking good for a second, albeit against, I guess, now the worst team in MLS, but. You know, the whole Nani thing is crazy, and I think I'm really glad that Kellen Acosta actually said something on Twitter about it, because he's right, and he is not the only person to say it. Peter Vermees has said it. I don't know how many coaches have said it. The star players in this league tend to get, you know, extra treatment. I was actually surprised that Wayne Rooney was shown a red card on Saturday for that, just because it's Wayne Rooney, it's a marquee matchup. Are you really going to send him off? For it, it definitely deserved to be sent off. You know, were they actually going to do it? You've seen it last year with Zlatan smacking, I forget who it was for, Minnesota United, not for Minnesota United, for Montreal.
It was Montreal. I want to say it was,
I can't remember if it was,
I think it was Cabrera. It was one of the center backs. They were setting up for a set piece and they were both in the box, and it was one of the center backs was marking Zlatan, and then he kind of, there's, depending on the angle, you could, you know, judge intent. And in any case, the Montreal defenders studs down going into the foot, backing up into Zlatan, yeah. And then Zlatan, as opposed to pushing, just goes to immediately slap to the face. VR, straight red card.
Yeah, I mean, I think those are you know, you need to see, like, Nani should have been sent off. It should have been checked. It should have been reviewed. Does that penalty kick happen if Nani is on the field there? I don't know. But Nani, I mean, the temper tantrum, everything was just, it was something to behold. And I love watching every single time it pops back up on my feed. I just laugh. And I watch the whole thing through again because it's incredibly just, it's such a petulant baby thing to do for him in that moment. And I think, unfortunately, that is going to be what everybody gets out of that game. But really, you know, I think Colorado should be disappointed with how they defended, in general. There were some easy things that they gave up, to Orlando City there, but you know, they should also, I think they should be proud in turn, with how they responded in a lot of those moments. I just think Bassett's goal was fantastic. The counterattack, with Mosquito was a very great goal as well. Really well played. That's kind of what I've been hoping to see more of from Colorado. We just haven't seen it yet. Hopefully we get to see more of that, but, I think you saw some good things from both teams in this game. It'll be interesting to see how they go out of this game, because I think everybody's like strengths played to the other team's weakness in this game, which is why we got the game that we did. I think it'll be interesting to see how do they manage their strengths, how do they manage their weaknesses from this on, because you know, it looked like for a while that Orlando and Colorado were just going to struggle scoring goals, and a lot of their games were just going to be a struggle. So I'd like to see them out of this game kind of prove that, okay, it wasn't just because of the opponent in this game and how Matt, you know, weaknesses and strengths matched up. But, you know, this is actually something that we can do, and we can do it consistently, no matter who we're playing. Now we got to work on our weaknesses, because, you know, regardless of the result for Orlando, both teams here are still in the bottom tier of their conferences.
Listeners, Dan and I are both members of the North American Soccer Writers Association, crudely the, you know, upstarty soccer writer, blogger, journalist equivalent of the Baseball Writers Association. I know there's the NHL press. I can't remember their acronym, but they do all the voting for all of the NHL end of season awards. We're a part of that association that has done a very good job behind President Jonathan Tannenwald. Hi, President Tannenwald, if by chance you're listening to us. Of fostering better relationships with the league and with pro as far as getting pool reporters set up and asking questions with officials and being able to give the referees a platform to explain their decisions in ways that I think other leagues have done a better job of, to allow for referee decisions to get explained. There has been some yellow tape and some back and forth and some iterative adjustments throughout the last couple of years regarding pool reporters and asking questions of VAR decisions and those discussions that previously were considered sacred or were causes for the pro and officials to not respond to questions at all. There has yet to be a really good mechanism for visiting reporters or reporters who are not physically at the stadium to ask questions. There was a significant delay after the Nani temper tantrum, headbutt standoff. You know, it was almost like a game of chicken of it's like, I'm going to stand here. Let's see who actually like walks away first. And then is ultimately the chicken in that situation between Nani and Kellen Acosta. And I would have been really, really curious to know what they were looking at if VAR was trying to check something and what those conversations were. Because you had the initial incident where Nani appears to go down in the box as the ball is coming to him, but it looked like there was some contact, albeit with Nani potentially already going down from Kellen Acosta. You had several choice words from Nani at the official for an extended period of time afterwards. And then you actually had the jarring between the two of them that I've seen similar instances where both players get yellow cards. I have seen, not regularly, but instances where something similar in MLS, both players get sent off. Or Nani, who is clearly the instigator both in being aggressive and in the actual headbutt motion, would have been given a straight red card and then maybe just a stern talking to Kellen Acosta to defuse that situation. So you have potentially the actual penalty. You have potentially a yellow card for simulation from Nani if you decide it's not a penalty or it's on the other end of the spectrum. You potentially have, I don't think that this is VAR-able, but you have referee abuse, and I would like to see MLS refs stand up for themselves a little bit more to try and cut out behavior similar to what Nani did by giving a yellow card for dissent to at least try and have a more civil, professional-level conversation and actual dialogue rather than just spouting four-letter words that begin with the letter F. So that was something that was in there. And then you had the incident that happened ultimately after play was stopped and, you know, Drew Fisher, you know, had to break up, you know, the schoolyard rumble that was about to unload there. I think Dom Dwyer and Tim Howard were both in the right mindset in terms of trying to break that up rather than in defense of their teammate and causing, you know, an actual scuffle with shoving or maybe even worse violence committed there. I think both of them were a little bit in the wrong in that they both went for the opposite player where, you know, I don't know how much of a relationship Tim Howard had with Nani. You know, I was looking because I actually was trying to figure this out. Dan, I talked to you about the Scottish barkeep who was at the bar I was at watching the game. He and I got into a discussion trying to figure out if Nani and Howard overlapped at Man United. Howard would have been on loan at Everton the year before Nani arrived, and then Howard would have had the transfer to Everton for the long term in the offseason. But maybe they saw each other when Nani was moving in and Howard was cleaning out his locker at Old Trafford. You know, if nothing else, they saw each other a lot in competition in the Premier League. So maybe there was a relationship there. Maybe Kellen Acosta and Dom Dwyer knew each other. But, you know, I thought, you know, if you really wanted to defuse the situation, I think Dom probably grabs Nani's hand and points him upfield. And I think Tim Howard probably should have just straight picked up Kellen Acosta and then carried him back towards the touchline. But so there was a lot going on in there. And I would have really, I want to give the officials the benefit of the doubt. I want to say that there was some reasonable explanation they had for giving nothing there or not actually going to VAR to review the situation. I did not have the capacity to do that. The current infrastructure and rules in place did not allow me to do that. And it could be that the officials had a perfectly good reason for not giving Nani a red card, where we've seen much worse, much less been given a red card. So I would have liked that explanation by the book. And based on what we've seen from President, I agree with you. Nani probably should have been given a straight red card. Or if you want to accumulate Andy yellows between, embellishment and then also... referee abuse, that would have been fine with me as well. Let's move on to... Oh, go ahead, Dan.
No, I was just going to say, I'm with you on that. I think it'd be interesting. It'd be with that network, too. I think there's a chance that, maybe either away riders who couldn't travel or something like that can at least reach out to those who are in place at the stadium to be like, hey, is anyone going to ask questions? We have one that we'd like to get in if possible. But yeah, I do think there, I wish there was a little bit more transparent. I also think it'd be interesting if, the pool reporter thing eventually came to that. Okay. So, the reporter submits, will like the rotates each game, like which reporter kind of goes in and does the questions. Maybe someone who's consistently there, but isn't on a tight deadline, or something like that after the games. There's a chance that every single game, there's a question asked if need be. And that there's an interview on a controversial call, like something like that, where a Colorado person, someone from the Post or you can reach out to whoever, is the pool reporter in that city and say, hey, can you please ask this question and kind of figure out a way that those kind of questions are getting asked? Because like you said, that pool reporting process is massive to, for ascertaining moments that are unexplainable, like that one. And what went on there, whether or not we get the truth out of it all the time is a different story. But, I think the pool reporting process is something that, I think needs to be utilized a whole lot more, for moments like that, regardless of the home team or the away team, who the answer quote benefits kind of a thing. I think there needs to be, the ability to ask those kind of questions.
Well said, Dan. Let's move on to the roundtable. We will start with mascots. The Seattle Sounders this week unveiled, or I guess brought back, their old mascot, Sammy the Sounder. Sammy was apparently swimming out and exploring the Pacific Ocean in his adulthood. I don't know if this was a callback to early MLS Seattle Sounders or possibly back to the NASL iteration of the mascot, but Sammy is an orca, or I guess a killer whale. He's kind of goofy and super friendly. Unlike Gritty, I don't think I'll be having any therapy sessions because of Sammy's existence. He looks really, really approachable. And as far as I know, Dan, unlike SeaWorld, the Seattle Sounders are in no way abusing or taking advantage of Sammy the Sounder. Two thumbs up?
Yeah, two thumbs up. Sorry, you kind of cut out there. Yeah, two thumbs up. I mean, it's fine. I don't know. Mascots are interesting. It's not Gritty. Gritty, as weird and scary as it can be, has become a wonderful... has become a wonderful cultural phenomenon. I don't know. New mascot, cool. I think didn't last year. I think once Gritty came in, we looked at a bunch of the mascots, and there's a lot of them. There's a bunch that like don't even make sense. Like, why is the fox in Houston? Like, are there a lot of foxes in Houston or something? I don't get it.
Because it's orange.
Yeah, I guess. No, yeah, orange animal. I mean, you could. I don't know. You could do like the Syracuse orange. If you want to,
you could have done Gritty.
They literally could have done Gritty. I don't know. Leave it to Philadelphia to have some crazy mascots, but Talon is still so far the sickest of the mascots. Although I am down with the orca. I think the best thing that I got out of this one was Brad Evans saying that he now has a job, quote tweeting. someone was asking about, who was actually behind the Sounders orca. So, it's cool. I don't know. It's a cool mascot, and it's kind of perfect for Seattle, Washington, and just that kind of city. An orca, that's pretty dope.
I completely agree with you. Let's move on to something else, Dan. I don't know. Were you able to watch the game between Montreal and NYCFC last Saturday?
I did not. So I did not see the portion where I forget who it was, but like slid through the infield and just like Lovitz. An entire chunk of grass. Yeah, Daniel Lovitz slid through. I saw the highlight of it later, but don't know, man. It was ugly on that field, and every single game so far for New York City FC has been pretty ugly.
Yeah, so for those of you who've been living under a rock, NYCFC plays at Yankee Stadium. Baseball is underway, so now we're maybe at the end of the season after the Yankees have, you know, not made the playoffs or been eliminated, or prior to them actually playing baseball in their baseball park. They have a different setup that they have with the infield dirt and then the sod laid over that. With the dimensions of the field, the pitcher's mound is not in play. Dan, you'd probably be able to speak to this better than I can, as far as like having like the dome of it and then actually having a metal shell and then removing it. I know at the old RFK Stadium, they actually had a button where the pitcher's mound for the old Washington Nationals setup was actually in the field of play, both for the Washington Redskins and for DC United with their pitches. But so the Yankee Stadium, they had that separated out. So the pitcher's mound is not in play. None of the bases, other than second base, obviously, are in play, but those are easily removed. And this setup has not been good. It has been criticized off by a lot of players, by a lot of coaches, particularly visitors. I want to say it was Peter Vermees, or maybe it was somebody else, Dan, who even suggested that the setup that they had at Yankee Stadium from City was actually not within the minimum regulation dimensions for FIFA. So in that, New York City FC is actually delinquent, and like every single one of their home games previously held at Yankee Stadium should be a 3-0 forfeit because of that, potentially, based on the laws of the game. So there's that situation. You've had rumblings, and it kind of comes and goes every single year with season ticket holder retention for NYCFC being down because they don't want to go all the way up to the Bronx. They don't want to play, you know, in a stadium that's not really fit for the sport that they're trying to watch, and they're waiting for a soccer-specific stadium. Mind you, listeners, that the New York Metro Stars at the time tried for a decade to make a soccer-specific stadium somewhere within the five boroughs work and weren't able to make it work and ultimately moved to Harrison, New Jersey. In the midst of that, they had a rebrand and ultimately became New York Red Bulls and ultimately built RBA Red Bull Arena. For, I want to say, at least 15 years, the NFL tried to put an American football stadium somewhere within the five boroughs of New York, and then just said, screw it, and then built MetLife Stadium in the parking lot adjacent to where the old Giants Stadium used to sit. And the NFL has more political sway and more money than God, and they couldn't make it work. This isn't something that's changing anytime soon. And maybe the one real exception that you would have had would have been the old racing grounds, where ultimately the preliminary deal is in the process for the Islanders to build a new version of the Nassau Coliseum to move closer to their actual ancestral home. So that's kind of out of it. There's no real obvious big chunk of unused flat quality, easily accessible by public transportation real estate available right now in New York, and it doesn't seem like that's going to become available anytime soon. If it did, New York Red Bulls would be playing there, or the New York Giants and the New York Jets would be playing there, or the New York Islanders would be playing there. This is a situation that is not changing anytime soon, and it's not a situation that's getting any better unless the New York Yankees are relocating to somewhere that's not Yankee Stadium. And it was particularly bad on Saturday, just with the way that they had the saw. Daniel Lovitz ultimately went in for a slide tackle and almost like got his foot under the sod was basically like over like an old like oriental like hallway rug almost. And Montreal absolutely unbased to the situation. On the YES Network, I was watching on ESPN Plus, you had Dominic Torrent, the head coach for NYCFC, saying that, you know, yeah, we have to play in the conditions. This is a bad look for a club that's aspiring to be a super club that has a lot of sway and a lot of money and resources and high expectations being owned by City Football Group. And this is not a good look from a PR standpoint, from a recruiting standpoint for other players. I guess it's a home field advantage in the sense that like Maxi Morales and Maxine Cheneau are used to it in ways that, you know, players on Western Conference teams aren't going to be used to it, Dan. But this is a bad look and it's not looking good anytime soon. And maybe the one big criticism that everybody had when NYCFC joined the league was the stadium situation. And the one thing that Don Garber at the time was pitching to the St. Louis's, and I want to say that who am I thinking of? That Minnesota and Atlanta hadn't happened at that point as well, that you needed a plan for a soccer civic stadium in a prime location. And that was the one thing that they just completely threw out the window for New York City FC. And it's a big glaring elephant in the Bronx right now, not living in the Bronx Zoo, and it's not going anywhere anytime soon.
Yeah, the whole situation sucks, especially when, you know, you've taken teams like Sacramento Republic and like St. Louis FC, you know, who have been trying to get in, and have been, you know, we've been doing this, we've got this, but, you know, they keep getting passed up for an NYCFC or someone with bigger money, kind of a thing. When the stadium situation is what it is, and, you know, honestly, New York City FC has only been good for like, so, you know, I it's frustrating. I understand the frustrations about, you know, the way everything has gone with it. And, you know, hopefully they get something done soon, or can find a better home somewhere else. You know, maybe you just kind of suck it up and see if Red Bulls will split with you. I wouldn't be surprised if Red Bulls said no. So then do you try and go play at, you know, at Citi Field? Do you go try and do something else? I don't know, but, you know, soccer, we are at a point, you know, where soccer and baseball stadiums, outside of a random exhibition, at a historic Fenway or Wrigley Field kind of a thing. We are at a point in America where soccer at a baseball stadium just really shouldn't be happening.
No, completely agree with you, Dan. You know, it's, I understand the USL team that's getting off the ground that has something in the works doing it at this point, but to have arguably one of the top five financed MLS teams in the league, let alone the one that's in the biggest media market that is also the corporate headquarters for MLS, be playing in a situation like this and have players subjected to this, that, you know, borderline was dangerous. Like, Lovitz could have rolled his ankle over in that situation, and then we'd be having, you know, we'd be having a very different conversation, and, you know, we'd have a lot of Montreal fans crying foul, you know, at those circumstances that created it. You know, it's not a good look for the league. I think the word embarrassment would be accurate at times for it. It's also something that's not going to change, and it's a bed that Don Garber and company made a long time ago and tucked in really, really tight, knowing what they were accepting at this point. So I don't see a path out of the situation, and it's not going to get any better anytime soon. You know, I guess for our sake, Dan, you know, as writers, you know, the teams that we cover, we do not have to, in a mandatory sense, watch so many games at the stadium that have bad sight lines and are not conducive to quality soccer in the same way a proper rectangular pitch with an even uniform quality surface would have. Let's move on to happier stadium news, Dan. There's been some rumblings that potentially Sacramento Republic is getting one step closer to getting shovels in the ground at their Rail Yard Stadium. What's going on, and what can you tell us?
Yeah, so actually, as we started recording, they were still in the city council chambers. That has since cleared up. The stadium, basically the agreement within the city and to develop the land, has, you know, the deal's been pretty much given the go ahead, needed to go through city council tonight. They held a special chamber session for it, and it passed unanimously. So Sacramento Republic, and then at the end of it, the mayor of Sacramento promptly pulled up on the screen an email that said to Don Garber that said, "We're ready," simply, and sent it. And that was the end of the city council meeting tonight in Sacramento. So I think that, you know, that kind of shows, you know, where they're at. I would be shocked, you know, outside of, you know, you've got Nashville coming in, you've got Austin coming in, and you've got Miami potentially coming in. Right now you're looking at it, I wouldn't be shocked if Sacramento is the next team in. I think out of anyone else who was close in the last round, you know, Sacramento right now is at the top in terms of being close. And they've shown for markets that have shown that there's a nice little fever for soccer in that market, but at the same time have their stadium deal ready and in hand, like a Nashville did. That makes them that much more, desirable. And, you know, Detroit hasn't really shown that it's a soccer market. San Antonio is okay in USL, but they don't have a concrete plan. A lot of the other stadiums at the moment aren't concrete plans happens going forward. You know, Austin is pretty much a done deal. Miami is now a done deal with their stadium that they're going to end up getting. So there's, you know, Nashville is pretty much done with and is on their way to getting their stadium as well. So, you know, you look at what's coming down the pipeline. Sacramento is obviously the closest to being ready. I mean, they literally will be putting shovels in the ground soon. So I think this is the thing that, you know, this pretty much all but wraps up them as one of the next expansion teams. And I'll say it's about freaking time because, you know, there's been a lot of teams that have leapfrogged them. You know, they were the Cincinnati before Cincinnati opened up a stadium with 10,000 people, sold out every single game and won the league championship in their first year of existence. So those are, you know, that you've got to really kind of give them credit and give them a chance. Considering how much they've been passed up, but good for them to get it done. They needed a couple more investors. Those investors came along. Seems like the stadium plan, towards downtown is going to be a go. So it's overall, I think that's very good, for, what's come, for, Sacramento Republic.
Well said, Dan. You know, I'll say if Sacramento ends up getting in at any point, and ultimately there are four MLS teams in the state of California, like I think a proper, you know, supporter-driven, supporter-initiated trophy, you know, a la the Cascadia Cup, will be in order. You know, you can still have El Tráfico. I will openly petition the league if ultimately the Cali Classico is shut down at some point, or at the very least the San Jose Earthquakes aren't allowed to play games at Stanford Stadium against the LA Galaxy. But I think something between those, you know, with the NorCal rivalry, the SoCal rivalry, and then certainly the history that the Quakes and the Galaxy have more so than any of the other teams playing each other individually head-to-head, I think a proper California Derby, you know, Golden State Cup or something like that, I think would absolutely be fantastic and fun and pursue a lot of banter and a lot of memes that I think all four fan bases are certainly very, very good at when the San Jose Ultras decide to actually be on Twitter sometimes. Sometimes they just want to drink beer and have their shirts off, which, you be you guys, it's not something for me, but if it makes you happy, all the more. Let's move on to other stadium news, Dan. We've got some initial renderings from what the Miami Park, the old abandoned golf course next to the Miami International Airport, could potentially look like. It's really, really interesting. It kind of has like a wing feature in the animation they had. They had the two white herons kind of come in, and then one of them flew away and then like made a shape with their wings that then crudely turned into the shape of the actual roof that they had. I think it's really, really nice just from an architectural standpoint and the general plan that they've laid out in terms of development of that entire lot, you know, the nine-hole golf course. It's not just going to be a stadium. Obviously, they're going to have parking situations set up, some residential, commercial space, some open fields as well to have more of a community gathering area in ways that you've seen other MLS teams try to aspire to have in that situation. I'm struggling off the top of my head to think of anyone that is a really good example of the recent stadiums that have come into MLS. I guess you kind of add that just with all the fields up around the area in Frisco, Texas, but maybe that's a bad example in terms of the vision that they appear to have. I guess my bigger issue with this is something that still hasn't been on the ground. I was just writing for Last Word right into the beginning of 2015, right after, within 6 months of David Beckham retiring after playing the half season with PSG after finishing out his career in 22. So I guess this would have been 2013. So this would have been fall 2013, less than 12 months after David Beckham finished up playing with the LA Galaxy, saying that this was going to happen. They had a press conference, I think, when they were officially accepting the expansion bid to come in. And that was going to be what I think... that might have been maybe 1-2 years ago. And like the big thing that I was drumming up on Twitter is going back and looking at the YouTube stream of the full coverage of the initial announcement. There's basically nothing that was different about them. No new specifics about the stadium. This was after they were talking about having the Waterfront Park Stadium that would have been in the open air space right next to AAA, where the Miami Heat play their games. Revitalization of one of the harbor islands, the literal floating stadium. There was a really cool concept, a terrible idea from the beginning, and then also potentially putting it next to Marlins Park as well. Like they've had like 5 or 6 iterations of this, and none of them have really worked. There's a lot of political complexities, there's a lot of transportational complexities, a lot of gentrification and, you know, social social, economic, ethnic complexities to Miami and the different neighborhoods and what this looks like from a gentrification standpoint that are obviously worth hashing out. But now the only thing that's really certain is that Miami's going to drop almost $200 million to revitalize Lockhart Stadium. And is that really that far away from just some of the other bad investments that we've had? Like, we're at a point where Dick's Sporting Goods Park, as much as it was a nice concept and a nice idea, is so profoundly outdated in terms of what we know about stadiums and the expectation that the league has for new venues coming to the league. And obviously, Allianz Field is probably going to at least match it, possibly raise the ante on that. Certainly, Bank of California stadiums up there, maybe not from a location standpoint, but from an architecture standpoint and a revitalization of a club and a stadium atmosphere. I would certainly put Children's Mercy Park into that category as well for you, Dan. But okay, you're going to Lockhart Stadium, you're going to revitalize it. Okay, some of the renderings look okay, but like, it's an abandoned lot effectively that's right next to, that's closer to Fort Lauderdale than it is to Miami. That's going to be a haul for people. People aren't going to embrace you in that situation. Like, they tried that in MLS and it didn't really work. They tried that with the Fort Lauderdale Strikers in NASL. It didn't work. I don't see how that works. That's effectively a placeholder just for you to try and get on the field. And kind of like with New York City FC, you can't be this is the temporary plan. You know, it's like Brexit right now, where Theresa May and Parliament doesn't really have a plan. It's they voted on Brexit, but not how they were actually going to execute it. And it looks like an absolute mess. And New York City FC came in and it's like, yeah, we're going to play at Yankee Stadium, but we have bigger visions. We just don't have it planned out whatsoever. So you can't have a temporary plan and then the actual plan be a blank sheet of paper that says TBD. And so I feel like that's what Miami's going out in that situation. I think it's great that they're revitalizing Lockhart Stadium. That'd be a greater place for, you know, high school football games to go to potentially. A better just a general venue for the local area if they don't want to do anything with FAU, because they've got a new on-campus gridiron football stadium for the Owls there. But I don't know what to make of the situation. Yeah, the renderings look really good, but the renderings when they were going to put it right next to AAA look fantastic. The renderings on the island look fantastic. Parking and getting the ramps to work and everything in Miami Harbor, not so much, but like, this just, it's turning into a big mess, and I just feel like we could be having a show right now, Dan, 6-7 years from now. Miami's kicked off, they're stable in MLS, and they're still playing at Lockhart Stadium, and it's still really hard for them to connect in with the city of Miami. With that, Dan, let's move on to Pick'ems. We will start this coming Thursday. This will be tomorrow if you're listening to us on Wednesday, the 10th of March. Sporting Kansas City hosting Monterrey. This will be at 9 p.m. Eastern on Yahoo Sports. Dan, I assume you'll be there. Does Sporting have any hope in this one, or is this really just about looking respectable in front of the cauldron?
Yeah, I don't think there's a whole lot of hope Sporting Kansas City getting, at least getting the tie even. I mean, this one, it's pretty much out of the question at this point. It would take a miracle. However, I do think they'll get something out of it. I'll say Sporting Kansas City wins this at home, just because Mexican teams do not travel well to MLS stadiums, and Monterrey itself has not traveled well. I'll say the Sporting wins like 2-1.
I'll take a 1-0 on this one. I think in terms of Monterrey's game plan, it'll be very, very similar to what they did in Atlanta, that I think was a 1-0, or it might have been 1-0 Atlanta, or I think it was 0-0, and Monterrey was really sitting back. You know, they were managing the result, not trying to exhaust themselves. Obviously, Monterrey is trying to finish out the Klaus Asura really strong as they're, you know, trying to secure their seeding as far as the playoffs go for their league play. So I think they'll manage the result. I don't think they're going to be offensive or really try to make an open game. Dan, will any of the weather that I'm probably getting tomorrow be in Kansas City by Thursday?
No, we're not supposed to be cold on Friday and Saturday, I believe. Start to warm up again on Sunday.
Okay, so, you know, I'll take 1-0, maybe 2-1 in this one for Sporting. I think they'll be able to find a goal, but, you know, Monterrey is going to be playing the scoreline, and the scoreline doesn't have to have them put in a whole lot of effort other than until the final third. Let's move on to the Saturday league matches. We'll start with a rematch of MLS Cup just a couple years ago. Seattle Sounders hosting Toronto FC. Both teams playing relatively well. Toronto's found themselves. Pozuelo has been fantastic. The Seattle Sounders are possibly the most interesting tactical story in MLS right now. 4 p.m. Eastern on ESPN+. Dan, who you got and why?
I'm going to take Seattle in this one, just because they're home. Toronto doesn't travel well playing on turf, and I think Toronto still has some. Toronto's a good Eastern Conference team, but I don't think being a good Eastern Conference team means you can compete with the upper echelon of the West on a regular basis. So I'm going to go with Seattle in this one. I'll say 3-1.
I'll take 3-2 in this game. I think Toronto's found some stuff a lot better, but I think Chicago Fire, they got a 2-2 draw over the weekend at BMO Field, showed some of the weaknesses that Toronto has defensively, and having to fly all the way across the country and then play on turf isn't going to do them well. I will put an asterisk on, I'll say 3-2 on the contingency that Raul Ruiz Diaz is able to start. He was in training today and presumably could be available for the Sounders game midweek at Colorado that I will be attending. But if he's able to play in that one, then I think the Sounders at full strength. And outside of maybe LAFC and, you know, I would say a fully healthy and definitely counterattacking DC United, I'm not sure that I don't like either of those teams to win at Seattle, but I wouldn't pick Toronto over them. And in that, I will have Toronto losing this game 3-2. Let's move on to the nightcap. This will be Allianz Field opening for the first time ever. Minnesota United hosting New York City FC. This will be at 5 p.m. Eastern on ESPN2. Dan, who you got and why is it the Loons?
Why is it the Loons? The Loons are good. Their attack has been good. I'm intrigued to see how they decide to roll out. I know Adrian Heath, I think, is playing mind games, said something about, you know, hey, sometimes injuries drop people from the squad, and if people come in and fill in for injuries and do well, you know, they might stick, in reference to Darwin Quintero not
total
being in the squad
games.
Last
total
weekend.
Total mind games.
Right. I do not see Minnesota United opening their home field without the best player that they've ever had in their club history in Darwin Quintero on the field. I think this team is good. I think they need to find themselves without Darwin Quintero, though, a little bit. If I'm Adrian Heath, I don't necessarily try and experiment that way, unless he's not healthy, in this inaugural home match. But, I don't know if any team has lost a stadium opener. I'm sure they've certainly tied them, but to open a brand new soccer specific stadium, I don't believe any team has like actually lost that game. I would expect 100% Minnesota United to win this one. I will say by a score of 3-0 because I don't think New York City FC is any good.
Yeah, I was going to take the exact same score line, so for the sake of being different, Dan, I'm going to take 2-0 on this one. I think this is all mind games. Darwin Quintero starting this game and going at least 65 minutes in this one. I think he'll get a goal in this one. And then maybe something off of a set piece. You know, we'll take maybe Aiko Parra dunking on, Alexander Callens, for example. I think this is going to be Minnesota United from start to finish. New York City FC is not very good right now. I don't like any of the offensive ideas that they have, especially if they have to go up against the buzzsaw up the middle that are Aiko Parra and Ozzy Alonso. I think I'll take the Loons. I'll take them in a clean sheet, convincing victory from start to finish, and Minnesota United's going to feel a lot better about themselves. Then let's move on to the late night game. This will be on ESPN Plus at 10:30 p.m. Eastern. LA Galaxy hosting the Philadelphia Union. Dan, who you got and why?
I'm going to go LA Galaxy on this one. Philadelphia has been kind of intriguing, but I think Galaxy at home should be able to take care of business. So say 2-1 to the LA Galaxy over Philadelphia.
I'll take 3-1 in this one, but I'll put an asterisk and say that there'll probably be a call, like a PK. You know, Zlatan's been getting PKs and free kick opportunities pretty much going his way. Definitely a lot more pull and a lot more benefit of the doubt than Nani, I think, would get on any given day with any MLS official. So I think it'll be 2-1 close, and then the Galaxy will get something with, Philly trying to go for the draw, in this one. I don't like either defense in this game. I think the LA Galaxy defense has gotten a lot better. David Bingham had a heck of a game at Vancouver, you know, didn't have to do a whole lot on stopping the Ali Ghanan, PK Panenka, you know, that was basically a chip shot that basically landed right next to David Bingham's lap. But, you know, he had a couple really good saves. Dave Romney and Daniel Serres, I thought, you know, did a good job of not making any critical mistakes and just punting it out of harm's way and living to fight another day. That said, that defense is really, really slow and Philadelphia is really, really fast. So I do think that they will get a goal probably on the counterattack. You know, let's say the young kid, Erickson, who's been starting as the number 10, I'll say he'll find Fafa Picot. He'll probably burn Jorgen Kjelvik, cut inside, and then beat David Bingham with a shot that he wasn't going to be able to stop. But, you know, I'll take Zlatan probably getting a goal in this one. And, you know, let's say Sebastian Legette and Roman Alessandrini get the others, and the Galaxy are, you know, rolling with their two big DPs back with them. Let's move on to the Sunday games. The only Sunday game we have, this will be Sporting Kansas City hosting the New York Red Bulls, 7 p.m. Eastern on FS1. Dan, who you got and why?
I'm actually going to take Sporting Kansas City in this one. So what Sporting Kansas City have been doing is they've been playing this squad rotation of back-to-back games with the top team and then a rest game. So that's kind of what they did last week, is they did back-to-back games, and then Sunday was the rest game, the rest team. So Thursday, presumably, will be full strength again, and then Sunday again should be full strength again, especially since there's a very good chance that their season will be over at that point, and they will be on to or not their season, but their CONCACAF Champions League run will be over at that point, and then they will have a full week off before heading out to San Jose, where I will meet them for their matchup against the Earthquakes. So for that one, I'm expecting them to have as close to a first choice lineup on Sunday as possible. Especially if CONCACAF Champions League is going to be out the window. I am assuming they're going. New York Red Bulls have been very bad lately and have been struggling. They cannot create quality scoring chances for some reason, for the life of them, and they just haven't been as good as they were last year and in their supporter shield form. So, I'm going to say Sporting Kansas City ends up getting the win on Sunday. I'll say 2-0 over the New York Red Bulls, thanks to Christian Namath.
I'll take a 1-1 draw in this one, if for no other reason. I think last week's loss, New York Red Bulls have had two really, I would say, borderline embarrassing losses early on in the season to Western Conference, or not Western Conference teams, but, you know, they had the loss to Orlando when Sasha Kljestan got the goal a couple weeks back, and then they did not look good at all against a very undermanned Minnesota United. I believe Quintero didn't even play in that game. He definitely didn't start. So I think they're looking for a response from Chris Armas and company, especially on the defensive side of the ball. They'll be on a full week's rest. You know, Sporting, you know, is on the, you know, they're getting to the end of their CCL time. So, you know, I have to feel like a wall or a dud game is coming somewhere in there from a league play standpoint. You know, this isn't going to be Montreal Impact walking in and losing 7-1. I don't think it'll be pretty. I don't think it'll be convincing. But I'll take a gutsy 1-1 draw from the New York Red Bulls in what statistically and via performance you'll probably take as Sporting Kansas City probably should have won it. BWP hasn't scored in a while. You know, maybe he nicks something, gets something really lucky, and then it's going to be hold on to your butts to try and keep a draw. That is it for us, Dan. It is time for last words. Where can people find you on Twitter, and do you have any last words for this week?
Yeah, so you can find me on Twitter at SperryDandelion4, and my last words this week are a big hearty congratulations to Academica Sporting Club from my hometown of Turlock, California. They have qualified to the U.S. Open Cup this year thanks to a incredible comeback on their home field. It's actually funny. I used to practice and play out on the stadium that they call their home field before the, you know, it was known as, oh, we're going to go practice out at Academica, which was just this kind of a field and this, you know, very low level amateur, local amateur team that was just kind of playing out at this Portuguese Catholic church kind of out in the countryside, and all of a sudden now they're a member of NPSL. They ended up in this setup and they won. They were down 2-0 in the night going into the 90th minute, scored two goals to force extra time, then were down 2-3 in the 124th minute only down to nine men, where Gerardo Cáceres stepped up and scored a screamer of a free kick from about 35 yards out. I won't say 35 yards out. 25, definitely 25 yards out. Ripped it into the upper corner to send it to penalty kicks, where they eventually won and qualified for the U.S. Open Cup. An awesome story from my hometown. All, you know, fit with the supporters, a supporters group itself. You know, there's a lot of really cool things going on there. So congrats to Academica. It's going to be an awesome story to watch through the U.S. Open Cup, even if they go in and lose. The fact that they were able to qualify in the manner that they did, an incredible match, an incredible moment. I believe I've retweeted the goal too. You can see that tied it in extra time. It sent them to penalty kick shootout. A hell of a game. And props congrats to Gerardo Cáceres. Funny, I was sitting there and I was like, who is this guy? I went and looked, and it's someone that I've like played against in the past as well. So pretty cool. You know, just fun stuff from my hometown, and props to Academica for getting the job done. Which also leads me to one quick point, is that the fact that ESPN Plus has picked up the entirety of the U.S. Open Cup tournament this year. That is awesome. I am so happy for that. That way we won't be searching for janky, crappy YouTube feeds all the time. They will be on ESPN Plus, right on my Xbox app. I will be able to watch all of the fun that is U.S. Open Cup, and makes it available and accessible to a lot of people now. At least gets that tournament some sort of national feel. So awesome stuff with the U.S. Open Cup happening, not only in my hometown, but nationally as well.
Excellent stuff, Dan. I am going to be talking about all the cold weather. As I said, you know, it was 80 degrees today in Denver. You know, I was able to wear shorts in the afternoon. Work's a little bit stricter, so I definitely had to wear long pants, but in any case, it's an office setting. But tomorrow, Dan, a blizzard is coming in. There is a possibility, but it is not likely, that we could be having another bomb cyclone forming as well, that should be moving away from the stadium by the time kickoff for the Rapids against the Sounders is set to take place. But you know, the opening game of the season for the Rapids was Snow Classico. Kickoff temperature was 18 degrees. We had a cold game for St. Patrick's Day against Sporting Kansas City. That was 37 degrees at kickoff. And then we had some pretty good Rapids, press box, beanie fashion going on for the game against Houston. That was a lowly 43 degrees that got down to almost near freezing by the time I exited the stadium. Dan, I have one plea to the weather gods, and I know you're a bit more of a weather, you know, storm surge kind of a buff. So I don't know if there's a deity for this. I don't know if you have greater connections than I do, being someone informed in that space. But I would like you to ask Mother Nature or whoever the powers that be that I have a nice weather game for at Dick's Sporting Goods Park prior to the month of June, please. It's just been a lot of cold temperatures. It hasn't really, really been pleasant. It has shown in the style of play and the discomfort of the players in postgame. It has definitely shown in terms of how many butts are in seats at kickoff. Colorado's a wonderful state. Yes, we have winter. Winter is coming to an end. I would just like it to be sooner rather than later. I just want a nice 65-degree kickoff and then have the sun not go down before halftime. And that is all that I'm asking. Dan, if there's anything you can do on that front to create the mojo for that to manifest itself. Listeners, if you've got any ins with the weathermen or whoever, you know, the weather dominator that Cobra is working, that G.I. Joe is trying, that G.I. Joes are trying to dismantle, you know, get the word out to them. I would like to have a nice weather home game for, prior to halfway through the season, please. Listeners, you can follow me on Twitter at LWS Matt Pollard. Check out all of our content, all season long at lastwordonsoccer.com and at lastwordsc across all social media platforms. You can subscribe to Last Word Soccer Club Radio wherever you get your podcasts. Just search Last Word on Sports, or LWS Radio, and you'll find us and a whole bunch of other great stuff from the Last Word family. Thank you to our sponsor, Roughneck Scarves, the official scarf supplier of MLS, USL, and US Soccer. Get your custom scarves for your group or your team at roughneckscarves.com. Listeners, we will see you next week.